overwhelming majority of Americans believe their country is held in lower esteem than in any time in recent history. That America has lost whatever moral authority is enjoyed within the family of nations, in large part through ill-advised military adventures, heavy-handed diplomacy, and overbearing unilateralism. The person occupying the Oval Office this January will face the challenge of undoing the damage done and of redefining America's role in the world. I'm Dave Mazza. Today on KBOO, I'll be talking with someone who has been involved in formulating foreign policy and advising presidents since the Carter administration. Madeleine Albright is the first woman to hold the position of U.S. Secretary of State, serving in that capacity from 1997 to 2001. A native of Czechoslovakia, Secretary Albright also served in the National Security Council and as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She chairs the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. She's the author of several books, the latest entitled Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. And I want to thank her for talking with us today about some very important issues.
Great to be with you, Dave. Thank you.
Well, before we go into some of the major themes of the book, I'd like to talk about, it's actually part of one of the themes you discuss, but you also wrote about it recently in the New York Times in an essay called The End of Intervention. You talk about the international system being at a crossroads that's challenged by the survival of totalitarianism, the refusal of states within a region to act collectively around problems, like in the case of Myanmar, and the resurgence of national sovereignty. What role has past U.S. policy had in creating the situation we now find ourselves in?
Well, I think the international system is in a state of confusion, and never easy, I think, to behave in a way that is multilateral, which actually is a word people don't like, but mostly is in partnership, is that, or sharing, that's what it means. I think that where the U.S. has had a role in putting us in the wrong direction is that we have acted unilaterally, that we have, and that is evident in our actions in Iraq. And I think that it has damaged this concept that is so important for the 21st century of some kind of an international system in which we understand our responsibilities as a major country in terms of our interdependence with other countries, the fact that many problems cannot be solved unless they are solved in common with other countries, and that there is a responsibility to do something about an issue where other human beings are either being killed ethnically or starving as a result of a natural disaster.
Well, in that respect, and I mean what we're really talking about, as you mentioned in the title of that essay, the end of intervention. We are talking about coming up with a way to intervene for humanitarian purposes, and which may sometimes require more than just delivery of aid. How does a country like the United States establish guidelines for doing that sort of being involved in that sort of thing without it sliding into the sort of behavior we've seen, unfortunately, too often in the past, particularly the recent past, where intervention for a good cause becomes, you know, at least viewed by those on the receiving end, occupation or imperialism?
Well, it's very hard. There's no question about it. And I think that a lot of aspects are in the eye of the beholder, the perception of it. But one way to avoid that perception is, in fact, if things are done in conjunction with or according to a mandate by either the international organization, that being the United Nations, or a multilateral alliance like NATO.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if there are actions taken that would alleviate the situation in a third country, and they're done within a context of an international mandate, it helps a lot. But the problem is the following, and it's a very hard one, which is that our whole system has been based on national sovereignty. But national sovereignty also carries with it the following responsibility, which is that the leader of X country's job is to protect its population. and to do that job. And now there is this whole new concept that if the leader doesn't do the job, then the international community has some responsibility. But this is a very tough issue because the U.S. is the country, I think we speak about our national sovereignty more than many others, and yet we do see some kind of international responsibility. But this is what's making the whole situation so difficult and why the Iraq action was so damaging to our reputation, because it then makes us suspect when we try to do something in some other country that really has no other goal except to help the people.
Well, you mentioned Iraq, and one of the things that you set out in lining up setting out some of the challenges in the book for the president-elect to be dealing with is developing a more productive working relationship with the Arab and Muslim worlds, and clearly Iraq is a big piece of that. Now, do you still advise that we should have a timetable for withdrawing out of Iraq?
Well, the thing that I've said is I do think that we need a systematic way of getting out of Iraq. We may differ, and there are a number of different ideas out there in terms of how long it should take, but I think that with the advice of military commanders, it is important to make clear that we are coming out of Iraq. For instance, Senator Obama has said that 1 to 2 brigades a month and leaving some small residual force there to deal with the remnants of Al-Qaeda and to protect the Americans, the diplomats there. But I think what's most important is a decision to actually begin an orderly process. The government of Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki, is also talking about some kind of a scheduled way of removing the troops, and I think that that is the direction in which we are going.
But, you know, we're talking largely about removing combat forces. What about the other aspects of the military presence? I mean, many Americans and many people in the Middle East are concerned that even if the troops are pulled out, there are going to be bases and some sort of military presence for a long, long time. And isn't that also just going to be a continued source of problems for trying to build a good relationship in the Muslim world?
Well, I think we have to make clear that we are not going to have permanent bases in Iraq. I think that's a very, very important point. There are other ways, I think, to make clear America's interest. I mean, there are lots of discussions about over the horizon and aircraft carriers and various things, but the bottom line is that we have to make absolutely clear that we will not have permanent bases in Iraq, and that we want to have a different relationship with countries in the Middle East, even those with whom we disagree, which is why I have also been advocating having talks with Iran and trying to look at some kind of a regional diplomatic approach to the issues in Iraq, because clearly it is not just what's going on inside Iraq, but in the region that is also destabilizing. If for no other reason that there are something like somewhere between 2 and 2.5 million Iraqi refugees coming out of the country, some of them settling in Jordan and the other neighboring countries. So I think that a regional diplomatic approach is more important than a military one at this point, because there has to be a political solution to the problems in Iraq.
Well, I want to come back in just a moment to the withdrawal out of Iraq, but you mentioned Iran, and it comes to mind that in looking through your book, you talk about one of the dangers is that we tend, at least certain administrations have tended to create the image that countries like Iraq represent a new fascist threat, similar to having to deal with Hitler. And that sort of framework is not only a straitjacket, but a very dangerous one for us to put ourselves in. It seems to us that's what we've done, certainly with Iran. How do we get ourselves out of that straitjacket beyond opening up talks? Are there other things we should be doing
Well, first of all, I think it was a real mistake in terms of creating this axis of evil, because that makes it very difficult and links countries together that actually don't have that kind of a relationship, and so that was counterproductive. I think that what is important, Iran, I believe, is the country that's gained the most out of the war in Iraq. It is a country of great concern to us because we don't know what it's doing in the nuclear field, and we do know that it supports Hezbollah and Hamas, organizations that practice violence and terrorist activities. So it's certainly a complicated country with which to deal, but I think that we need to understand it better. It is not a totally monolithic place. Recently, we've been reading about the problems that President Ahmadinejad is having, not only with his health, but with the economy, and that the tradesmen in the bazaars have closed their shops because they didn't like the imposition of a tax, and the promises that Ahmadinejad has made to the people on the economic front are not bearing fruit, so there's a problem there. There also are generational differences with the young people being much more open-minded. So we need to know more about it and create kind of a framework of incentives and disincentives in order to try to figure out how to solve some of the problems with Iran. They're not easy, but we certainly can't get there by deciding never to talk to them. And by the way, five former secretaries of state met recently and said we should be talking to Iran, three Republicans and two Democrats. So I think that is the step forward.
Does that framework include recognition that Iran is, in fact, a regional power, and while it certainly shouldn't be meddling in the affairs of its neighbors any more than we should be meddling in the affairs of ours, that it is due a certain respect and recognition as such?
Well, I think that part of a dialogue would be a movement towards diplomatic relations. But let me state this. I think that while I advocate this, this is not simple. When we were in office, we tried to talk to, Iran and tried to try to figure out how we could improve our relationship, and they did not respond to a lot of the signals. So this is not, it's easier said than done, but you have to begin the process. I do think there is an issue in terms of where they're going with their nuclear programs. And they are signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and yet even Director General Al-Baradei of the International Atomic Energy Agency is saying that they're not cooperating. So I do think we need to move forward. We need to see them. They are, after all, Persia, the Persian Empire. They are a highly sophisticated country. We have had a very, very rocky relationship with them since the 50s. They have indictments against us. We have indictments against them. And the only way to move forward is for there to be dialogue.
Well, I don't want to leave the Middle East yet because, unfortunately, it is a major piece of our foreign policy picture and what the new president's going to have to deal with. But I'd like to go back a little bit to, talking about withdrawing out of Iraq. And we've heard, of course, Senator McCain has one view about staying in Iraq until we win. Senator Obama has talked about withdrawing from Iraq, but also redeploying and increasing the presence in Afghanistan. And one that I think is troubling to many Americans who are just as concerned about our continued presence there and probably is also, again, having an impact on our relationships with all of the Muslim world. But what do you see as the resolution in Afghanistan? What course are you recommending to the president-elect?
Well, first of all, Afghanistan has been a major problem for a very, very long time also. I mean, going back to the 19th century, and it has been an area of the world that has been fought over and has been very difficult to sort out for a long time. The other point here, though, is that it is from Afghanistan that those who attacked us on 9/11 came. And so there was, I believe, much more legitimacy to doing something about Afghanistan. And people actually supported President Bush's reaction to 9/11. The problem now is that Afghanistan and Pakistan have kind of been joined as a common problem of extremism and dissatisfaction and being a place that has welcomed various elements of al-Qaeda, and that is obviously of great concern to us. I do believe that it's important to pay attention to what has been going on in Afghanistan. I mean, the problem is that the Bush administration took their eye off the ball, and the Taliban has resurged, and they are using the money from opium poppy crop, which is what you make heroin out of, to finance themselves with new weapons and to be threatening to the government of President Karzai and to various other areas of the region. So it is of great concern, and I don't think anybody wants to be there forever. That would be a mistake, but I think that we do have to deal with whatever threats come out of Afghanistan. But here, Dave, what's interesting is this is being done in conjunction with NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a big test for NATO. NATO, there was a whole question about what the relevance of NATO was after the end of the Cold War. And one of the missions has been to go out of area, which means beyond the membership of NATO, in order to deal with threats to people's national interest. And so this is a NATO operation in addition to an American one. And I think that it is important that we try to not get ourselves in a position where it's a more and more dangerous area.
Now, is NATO, though, still going to be viewed by not only the Afghan people, but by others within the Muslim world as basically a Western presence in their region? I mean,
well, they are there actually with the consent of the government of President Karzai, which is a Muslim government.
But and there are those who say that he's actually just the mayor of Kabul.
Well, but I think others within Afghanistan welcome NATO. I think that there are those. I have to tell you, I met with a lot of Afghan refugees when I was in office, and they make very clear that they would like to have their country be a place where they didn't have to live in terror or under the dictatorship or the rule of the Taliban, who don't let women out of their houses and who are in many ways terrorizing a lot of the population. So I do think that ultimately extremism within Islam has to be dealt with by the Muslims themselves, but I don't see this as something that is the West versus Islam, but as a struggle for those who want to be able to live in their country in a way that allows them to exercise certain amount of freedoms and not be afraid to leave their houses.
Now, you've mentioned that Afghanistan and Iraq have become somewhat linked. We now see, of course, the incursions into Pakistan to try to deal with the movement of the Taliban there. And are we seeing now Pakistan just becoming an extension of this larger conflict?
Yes, and I think the Afghanistan-Iraq thing got linked by President Bush. I don't think they were linked, but I do think that Pakistan and Afghanistan are almost part of the same theater, so to speak, and clearly with the areas in the Northwest Territories where there doesn't seem to be any control, and al-Qaeda is roaming around, and people think, though I think they don't know, is that that's where Osama bin Laden is. And so there is the hope that the government of Pakistan will help in getting some control over the area and trying to figure out how to allow Pakistan to operate as a free democratic nation and be a country that can help in all of this. But it is this, I think, that, you know, I'm often asked about what I think is the most dangerous place in the world. I think Pakistan has everything that gives you an international migraine. I mean, it has nuclear weapons, poverty, extremism, corruption, now a huge financial problem, so that they have to ask for loans, and a weak government. And then they're in an area where they're absolutely crucial to us in terms of dealing with the problems in Afghanistan. So I think these are all linked and very, very difficult problems and a huge challenge to the next president, who, in addition to dealing with these two hot wars, has to deal with the issue of how to fight terrorism without creating more terrorists, how to deal with a broken nonproliferation regime, how to restore the good name of democracy, how to deal with the negative aspects of globalization, that is the growing gap between the rich and the poor, that whole bundle of issues of energy, environment, rising food prices, and now the global financial crisis. So there is a huge agenda for the next president, challenges which have to somehow begin to be turned into opportunities, because this is a very, very hard agenda that's out there.
Well, the Bush administration, and certainly we've heard that during, you know, previous administrations, the Reagan administration, but particularly with the Bush administration, the war on terror and this sort of ill-defined, you know, there's no clear definition of who the enemy is. It's terror. And it seems to me, how do you proceed? And I think it's agreed that everybody in the world would like to put an end to terror, but, you know, what sort of criteria or guidelines do you set down in terms of identifying what's actually terrorists and what's simply, you know, indigenous resistance to, you know, incursions from outside?
Well, I think that, you know, people have various definitions, and I think for me, a terrorist is somebody who kills innocent people. And they're murderers. And so what I think needs to happen is we need to isolate those and not lump everybody who disagrees with us into saying they're terrorists. I also disagree with discussing it as a war, because it's not going to, it didn't begin as a normal war. It's not going to end that way. And what we do by calling it a war is that we give more dignity to people that are just plain murderers, because they then become warriors within their own societies. And so I think we need to isolate the real killers and then not decide that everybody who disagrees with us is kind of lumped together as being part of some large network. But it is a problem. It is very difficult. And I think that there have to be better ways of not thinking that just whatever tribal units somewhere disagree with us, that they're part of some very much larger terrorist network. It would also be nice, frankly, if we did not give, you know, when I was in office, I was advised, frankly, not to give so much airtime to Osama bin Laden. That it was, you know, we in some ways make him even bigger by constantly, you know, running his tapes and thinking, making him central to everything.
So we've in some ways created our own worst enemy.
Well, I think we have to figure out, I mean, that we do have enemies. I mean,
right.
I think it would be naive to think that we don't have enemies, and it's naive to think that there aren't people that are just trying to kill us. I mean, they did. But the bottom line is that you have to figure out how to isolate those that are the real enemies and try to figure out how to deal with those who merely disagree with us.
You mentioned, of course, the concern about Pakistan with nuclear weapons, and that raises, of course, the issue of nonproliferation. Where are we at in terms of, you know, moving forward on nonproliferation, and what does the next president need to do?
Well, I think the real problem is that the whole system has broken down. The nonproliferation treaty was based on a bargain, and the bargain was that the nuclear powers would systematically disarm and the non-nuclear powers would not try to become nuclear powers. And both sides of the bargain have been broken. I mean, we now have North Korea as a nuclear power. And the nuclear powers have talked about new generations of nuclear weapons, the U.S. with the nuclear bunker busters, and there really have not been systematic talks. I think that what needs to happen is that we need to rethink the process. I would hope that the new Senate would give advice and consent to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, that we look at a fissile material cutoff treaty, because that's, after all, what they make the bombs out of, and get some kind of international, a better international control. But the current system has a huge loophole in it. And I often say that I don't know whether when President Eisenhower made his Adams for Peace speech in the early 50s, whether physicists didn't know or didn't tell him how easy it was to move from peaceful to nuclear weaponized systems, because that's the loophole. And I think that in rethinking the nonproliferation system, that has to be worked on. There might be some kind of an international nuclear fuel bank, but something different has to happen so that the worst weapons don't get into the hands of the worst people. And I was recently reading that there really is kind of a bazaar out there in various components of nuclear technology. So there has to be some better way to deal with this.
You talk a lot in the book, of course, about more than just sort of the direct foreign policy piece for the president in terms of restoring our position. We need to be looking at how to connect in energy development and, you know, environmental concerns. And maybe you could give us a, you know, briefly give us a feel for what those other pieces of the puzzle are that the new president has to put together.
Well, I think that, first of all, I mean, there are a number of things the new president can do to help restore our moral authority. Closing Guantanamo right away would be one of them, say, declaring torture illegal. I think signaling something very important, both in substance and process, which is to join in a very active way the climate change talks, because that's one of the first things that President Bush did was pull us out of the Kyoto talks. So I think that would help an awful lot. I think an energy policy of our own would be very important. I think that one of the really hard parts that's going to happen here is there's no question that the global financial crisis has kind of overwhelmed everything else. And the bottom line is that the other issues cannot be allowed to fall off the table or the radar screen. That just because energy prices have come down recently doesn't mean that we should not be looking at renewable sources of energy or alternative sources, or that we should not be thinking about how to deal with the variety of the environmental issues that are out there. And I think the most important thing for the next president is that he's going to have to multitask. And it goes to the first part of my book, which is about the importance of assembling a team of people who are smart, who are able to present diverse ideas to a president who appreciates the diversity of the ideas and then pulls people together in order to implement in some kind of a prioritized way. It is a very big job, I'm not going to say that any of this is easy. We have spent 8 very bad years. It's going to be important for the next president to take a very different approach for the American people, and then ultimately for the international system.
I wish we had more time to talk, but I do appreciate very much you taking the time out to talk with us today at KBOO. And again, I've been speaking with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in regards to her latest book. It's a New York Times bestseller, Memo to the President, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership.